Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boy, the president's not kidding about this economic roadshow thing, you know. He made another big speech today, kind of a put-up or shut-up for Republicans.
Here's the bottom line. If folks in Washington really want a grand bargain, how about a grand bargain for middle-class jobs?
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 30th of July. Good, as always, to have you with us. Chattanooga, Tennessee was the presidential venue of choice today, that Amazon warehouse you have been hearing oh so much about the last day or so. The speech this afternoon came with a twist, though, a hook, if you will, designed to lure Republicans. The president himself was fairly clear about the politics of the thing.
I don't want to go through the same old arguments where I propose an idea and the Republicans just say no because it's my idea.
All right, then, Mr. President, what do you got?
So I'm going to try offering something that serious people in both parties should be able to support. A deal that simplifies the tax code for our businesses and creates good jobs with good wages for middle-class folks who work at those businesses.
What's not to like? Businesses and Republicans get something, Democrats and consumers get something. Could work out pretty well all the way around. Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary explains what it's going to mean big picture.
Yeah, so this grand bargain. Nothing new here. Non-starter. Sorry. I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
All right, we kid, but only a little bit. I mean, when the Speaker of the House, as he did today, declares a plan from the White House dead in the water before the president even gives the speech, the process does kind of seem to have broken down a little bit. But hang on just a second here, because on the face of it, what the president proposed today looks like a win for American businesses. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer unpacks it for us.
Right now, the corporate tax rate is 35%. President Obama would lower it to 28%. Big gift to business, right? Not exactly, says Bill Gentry, a tax economist at Williams College.
The headline seems to be we're lowering corporate tax rates, but then you look below the headline and it says, oh, but we're going to raise revenue with this.
President Obama wants to raise revenue by eliminating dozens of corporate tax breaks, deductions that let multinational corporations stash cash in tax havens overseas. Right now, big multinationals pay an average tax rate of only around 12%, lower even than the 28% President Obama is proposing. So they'd lose out under the president's plan. But there would be winners, according to Ann Mathias. She's a tax expert at Guggenheim Partners.
The real winners would be domestic U.S. companies that don't have a lot of international operations. Some of the domestic healthcare services companies, domestic restaurant chains.
Mathias says these companies don't get the big tax breaks because they don't have big international profits. They're paying close to the full corporate rate. So that 28% rate President Obama wants would be a big tax cut for them. And there's one more huge winner.
This is lobbyist heaven.
Howard Gleckman is a tax analyst at the Tax Policy Center in Washington. He says lobbyists are already telling their multinational clients, we can fight the president's plan for a price.
They're all sending out their alerts to their members and saying, you're going to have to hire 3 more lawyers and this is going to be the biggest fight of your life. So this is wonderful if you're a lobbyist.
Gleckman doesn't expect companies that would win under the president's plan to do much lobbying. He says the losers always scream louder than the winners. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
If you were watching television last night, you might have noticed your screen suddenly go black in certain parts of the country. It was the result of the latest skirmish in a long-running war between Time Warner and CBS. Time Warner Cable says CBS wants too much money in return for its programs, so it blacked out the network's shows in New York, here in Los Angeles, and in Dallas for a spell last night. CBS says Time Warner is, and here I quote, engaged in a campaign of disinformation voodoo mathematics. So, is a Haitian religion really the best analogy here? No. No, it's not. Marketplace's David Weinberg has a better one.
When I heard about the blackout, I thought of two dinosaurs fighting over a bone while an asteroid bears down on them. So I asked Harvard business professor John Dayton what he thought of my analogy.
That's interesting. Certainly the asteroid might overdramatize the risks, but it certainly captures the idea of risks.
Dayton suggested a supermarket analogy, where CBS is a new line of Coca-Cola and Time Warner is a soft drink distributor.
And the distributor is saying, I don't think your brand's very good at all. And then the twist, as you say, is that maybe supermarkets are going out of fashion.
CBS wants Time Warner to increase payments to the network by as much as 600%. They are, after all, the number one network. And they have the NFL.
The payments that ESPN is getting are five or six times the payments that the networks are getting. Sport has particular addictive properties.
I also ran my analogy by Morningstar analyst Michael Cordy. He agreed that the asteroid was overkill. The idea that new innovations will kill cable providers has yet to be proven. He set his analogy in a fancy restaurant.
Basically, two people that have had a really good meal, and they're going to continue to eat well the rest of their lives, but they are fighting over the dessert.
The dessert being retransmission fees. CBS made $250 million on those fees last year. CBS's blackout could cause Congress to step in. It's done that in the past. And that could be bad for both parties. So, in the end, I think it's safe to say that Time Warner is a T-Rex drinking a can of Coke, and CBS is a Triceratops wearing a Peyton Manning jersey. And instead of an asteroid, it's a giant chocolate volcano cake. Or maybe Congress is the asteroid. Either way, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Man, oh man. Those of you in the mood for the happy music today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has let you down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The July unemployment report lands Friday morning. It's anybody's guess, of course, what the magic number is going to turn out to be. But when you're talking jobs and the American economy, there's always loads more to think about than just the headline. Here's one thing to think about. People who get laid off when their company gets into trouble, and then once the crisis has passed, they get their jobs back, but at lower pay with fewer benefits. The example of that that's been in the news of late, you can find it right on your supermarket shelves in the snack section. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Twinkies, the obscenely calorific cream-filled confections, are back after a brief detour through bankruptcy. And they're just as sweet, unless maybe you're the worker with the hairnet making Twinkies in Emporia, Kansas. Because the company that took over got rid of the bakery workers' union and is now employing some of the same people, but at significantly lower pay. Similar thing happened back in 2010 in Indianapolis. Engine maker Navistar laid off around 700 union foundry workers. They used to make about $28 an hour.
We took about $5 to $6 an hour wage decrease, increase in our insurance. That's a lot of money when you got family.
Danny Ernstis has three kids. He's a longtime United Auto Workers rep, and he's one of the 150 or so workers who have been called back to the foundry under a new UAW contract. I reached him by cell phone on the way home from his shift as a millwright.
You know, at the time in Indiana, there was no other jobs. I don't use the word forced into it because we made the decision democratically, and it's still a living wage.
Back in 2005, Alaska Airlines outsourced its baggage handler jobs. At Seattle-Tacoma Airport, that meant nearly 500 union machinists were turned into non-union contract workers overnight. They went from averaging $13.40 an hour to $8.75.
I'm one of the guys who took the jobs from those high-paid workers.
Spencer Havens is 22. He's got a high school diploma and a couple years of community college. 5 days a week, he loads luggage fast to meet Alaska's guarantee of 20 minutes or less to get your bags. He's a team leader and makes just over $12 an hour. His wife, Libby, works part-time in a daycare.
We were married June 22nd, 2013.
Right now, we're living with my grandmother.
When do you want to be in your own place?
As soon as humanly possible.
With what I get paid right now, I wouldn't be able, I would just be living paycheck to paycheck, and this way we can save up money to one day get a house.
Havens has joined with other workers trying to organize a new union. They're campaigning for a local ballot initiative that would push their pay back up toward the hourly wage that Alaska was paying before the outsourcing.
Now! Good job! Now!
Labor and community activists want voters in the city of SeaTac, where the airport is based, to set a minimum living wage of $15 an hour. It would cover all airport workers, baggage handlers, also parking lot attendants, food servers, hotel maids. But there is plenty of opposition to legislating those wages. Resident Vicky Lockwood spoke at a city hearing last week. She doesn't make $15 an hour, she says.
I'm not anti-union, but I'm anti-giveaway. And people need to acquire education and skills to make themselves worth more money.
Good jobs, decent jobs, mediocre jobs are better than no jobs.
Scott Ostrander runs the Cedarbrook Lodge in SeaTac with just over 100 employees. He says he can't afford to pay $15 an hour.
I'm going to be forced to lay people off, take away their livelihood. God, that hurts.
In spite of his own financial setback, Danny Ernstis, the foundry worker in Indianapolis, is a bit hopeful. He talks about new cooperation between the union and the company that could bring prosperity back to his wounded city. But he says it won't be easy to get over the beating he and fellow workers have taken.
We kind of look at it like this, you know, I got busted in the mouth, knocked my tooth out. I forgive you, but every time I smile, my tooth is gone.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a film airing on Frontline tonight on PBS that's going to resonate with a lot of people. It's about assisted living facilities, places that are often billed as alternatives to nursing homes. A.C. Thompson is the correspondent on the film. It's called Life and Death in Assisted Living. It's a collaboration between Frontline and ProPublica. A.C., good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
I wonder if maybe what we ought to do first is define terms here. This is assisted living, not nursing homes, right? What's the difference?
Exactly. Nobody knows the difference. People get confused about this all the time. Assisted living is a niche of senior housing that's between your own home and a nursing home. And the definitions vary from state to state. But basically what you're going to get is an apartment, some services, some food, and help with your medications, help to make sure that if you have dementia, hopefully you don't wander off, that sort of thing.
The quote in this piece that stood out to me is, assisted living is the rock America doesn't want to look under. That's a little scary and depressing all at once.
Right. This is kind of a black box world in many ways. People don't know what's going on in these facilities. They don't know what kind of laws or lack thereof are governing them. And I'll give you an example. I live in California. We have 7,500, 7,600 of these facilities in California.
Now, so, I'm sorry, say that again. 7,500 just in the state of California.
Exactly. It's a lot. Yeah. And if I wanted to find one for myself, hopefully I wouldn't, or for a family member, there is no information available online from the state about these facilities. I would have to go to a state office and look at a bunch of paper files after I made an appointment.
The mere size of that market, 7,500 just in the state of California, and yes, we have a lot of people, but it does suggest this is big, big business.
Exactly. You see, what started off as basically a reform movement, there were people who said, nursing homes are a drag, they're institutional, they're like hospitals, let's set up places that feel like home. That was a great idea. But over the last 20 years, what you've seen is that idea morph into a big business. And there have been problems as that's happened. You see these companies like Emeritus and the other big players, they have a very, very heavy emphasis on sales.
Emeritus, that's the company you focus on in this film. Tell me why you spent the time with this one firm.
So they have a market capitalization of more than $1 billion. They did $1.6 billion in revenue last year, approximately. And they have control over about 500 facilities spread across 45 states. The problems that they had in a lot of ways were reflective of the broader industry. So we saw problems with not training their workers properly, with not hiring enough workers and staffing the facilities properly, with neglecting residents. So that's part of why we focused on them. But also in particular, what we drilled down on was a real heavy emphasis on filling the buildings, making deals with prospective customers, and tracking every financial metric. Meanwhile, the company's top nurse said in a court case in California, I don't have any way to track whether the workers we employ have their legally required training. And it was that sort of binary there, really good data on the finances, not really good data on things like worker training that stood out to us.
The cost to the families, obviously, when something goes wrong in one of these facilities can be extreme. I mean, you know, you start and you end this piece with people who died in emeritus facilities. What is the prognosis, if you will? What's the outlook for regulation and for keeping a closer eye on some of these companies in the homes?
You know, I will tell you the truth is that I don't think people are paying a lot of attention to older folks in general. And what you've seen is sort of, a stasis when it comes to adjusting laws over the last 15 years to keep up with where the industry is going. There has not been a lot of action on that. The laws have been tinkered with, but they haven't been majorly overhauled in a lot of places. And I don't know if that's coming, honestly. I think really one thing that is going to have to happen is that consumers and the public are going to have to be really diligent and really investigative. They need to act like investigative reporters, frankly, to make sure that bad things do not occur.
And also it's mom and dad, right?
And also it's mom and dad, exactly. There's no good Yelp for
this. There's no good Yelp.
No.
That's
no.
that's right. The latest film from Frontline is called Life and Death in Assisted Living. It's a partnership with ProPublica. A.C. Thompson is the correspondent. Airs tonight on PBS. A.C., thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up.
While waiting for the end of the spin cycle, the target market female fantasizes that a male model has materialized in her kitchen and is making her a salad.
Yeah, no, she said fantasy, right? But first, let's do the numbers. With the Fed meeting today and tomorrow and GDP on the way tomorrow, Wall Street watched and waited. The Dow Industrials basically flat down, just a point, closed at 15,520. The NASDAQ picked up a 0.5%, 17 points, 36.16. The S&P 500 flat as well, ended things at 1685. Financials were mixed. Citigroup took home 0.25%. Bank of America was flat, but Morgan Stanley threw off 0.8%. Despite big gains in monthly home prices, the stock prices of some homebuilder shares headed to the basement. Pulte pulled back 1.25%. Lennar stepped down 0.6% today. All eyes continue to be on Facebook as it closes in on its $38 IPO price. The social network rang up another 6%+ gain today, closed just about 40 cents short of its high watermark. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses how companies market energy drinks to kids. The Commerce Department releases its first estimate gross domestic product for the second quarter. And who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. This crime-fighting character was introduced to adoring radio audiences on July 31st, 1930. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For a seemingly random three-digit number, your credit score can have a heck of an impact. It can help decide whether you get a loan or a credit card and the interest rate you might pay. Landlords look at it, insurers look at it, even employers look at it. So it's maddening when your credit report has a mistake on it. And it can be all the more maddening to try to get that mistake fixed. But sometimes good triumphs over bureaucracy. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the details.
Back in 2009, Julie Miller discovered someone else's debts were on her Equifax credit report. Justin Baxter is Miller's attorney.
She found out when she went into her local bank and tried to get a credit line with her son, and she was denied. And Julie has perfect credit.
For the next 2 years, Miller tried to correct the mistake.
She kept writing. They would just send her these form letters that said, send us more proof of your identity. But she would send them her driver's license, her W-2 statement, and she would just get that form letter back saying, prove who you are.
So Miller took Equifax to court. The jury awarded her $18.6 million in damages. The size of the award may be extraordinary, but having a mistake on your credit report isn't. Dave Jones heads the Association of Independent Consumer Credit Counseling Agencies. He says one out of every four credit reports has errors.
Oh, yeah. It's extremely common. They get account numbers mixed up, they get names mixed up.
And correcting the mistake can be difficult, says Liz Weston, author of Your Credit Score.
The big knock on the system is that it is so automated, and it's really hard to find a human being to help you.
The multi-million-dollar fine could make it easier for consumers to correct mistakes, says Dave Jones.
I suspect all three of those bureaus, however, are going to be seriously motivated now.
Julie Miller's attorney, Justin Baxter, has already gotten hundreds of emails from people wanting to file similar cases. Equifax did not respond to requests for comment. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There are a lot of jobs out there, good, honest, necessary jobs that those of us who don't do them might not really appreciate. You might even say we kind of hate them. We went out with a meter maid not too long ago. Those kind of jobs are what we're talking about. There are also jobs not quite as visible but viewed just as unfavorably by the rest of us. For example, when people and companies go broke, declare bankruptcy, there is a career to be had in stepping in to take over the assets and then, if they're worth anything, divide them up. Edward Wolkowitz is one such bankruptcy trustee. Mr. Wolkowitz, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Why is it that that bankruptcy lawyers, I mean, nobody wants to go see a bankruptcy lawyer. It's got to be, when you have people, clients come in, it must be not the best day of their lives.
Well, I think that it's not like you wake up in the morning and say, I think I'll go see a bankruptcy lawyer today. Generally, if you're a business, there are some serious underlying issues. If you're an individual, you get to the point where the phone calls from collectors are just too much to take, and bankruptcy can provide a relief from that.
Is this remunerative work? I mean, do you make a pretty penny doing this?
You can, and people do. Bankruptcy trustees in the consumer context get $60 a case.
I'm sorry, $60?
$60 a case.
That doesn't seem like a whole lot.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But in addition to that, they get an additional roughly 3% of the value of the property they liquidate and distribute to creditors. Mm-hmm. So that's where a lot of the money gets made for trustees.
What's the biggest thing people don't understand about bankruptcy that they maybe have a misapprehension about?
Well, I think people still believe that bankruptcy provides an ability to actually scam the system. And you know what? Yes, there are people who are out there trying to scam the system, and I used to be very skeptical. But, you know, you start looking at those things, and some of these credit cards run interest at the rate of 35%, and somebody who maybe 8 or 9 years ago borrowed $10,000 on their credit card and basically just paid the minimum could easily get up to close to $100,000 in credit card liability without having essentially gone and bought luxury goods, which a lot of people think they do.
Do people take it out on you personally?
No. I think that the reason for that is that even in an unpleasant situation, if you treat people respectfully, they generally respond. I'm empathetic to a lot of the problems people face. There were times in my life where we weren't doing so well either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mr. Wolkowitz, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Once again, thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
We mentioned the big news in advertising yesterday. Omnicom and Publicis merging in a multi-billion dollar deal to create the world's biggest ad firm. One of the interesting things about that deal, and one of the key things about advertising right now, is that the whole industry is more about your data, who you are and what you like, than it is about any specific product that's out there. In other words, says commentator Katie Brinkworth, we're all part of a target market.
At 6 a.m. on the dot, the 25 to 45-year-old target market female wakes up with the sun, excited to greet the day. For breakfast, the target market female debates whether to eat the yogurt brand that encourages her to be herself or the one that helps her poop. Today, like most days, the target market female chooses regularity over self-worth. She then walks to a local cafe,
As she waits, the target market female daydreams about fiber, smaller pores, and easy but creative recipes she can make with pre-cooked sausage. When she realizes the time, she rushes home to begin the most rewarding part of her day, doing the laundry. While waiting for the end of the spin cycle, the target market female fantasizes that a male model has materialized in her kitchen and is making her a salad, cutting the vegetables with his own chiseled facial features. While cleaning her kitchen, she hallucinates that she and the mop are engaged in a quasi-sexual relationship that's been broken up by the Swiffer. She tries playing hard to get with the mop, only to realize that it has begun a fling with a basket of pine cones she uses as holiday decor. Unsure whether the jealousy is real or fiber-induced, the target market female builds a fire with the pine cones and every other romantically threatening knick-knack, producing a very real and uncontrollable inferno. By the time the fire trucks arrive, the whole house is ablaze. When she realizes her loss, the target market female begins to cry, like women always do. In the end, the target market female is oddly comforted by the fact that she can wipe up all the tears, spilled gasoline, and broken dreams with one illogically absorbent quilted paper towel.
Katie Brinkworth is a contributor to McSweeney's, which is where we read her essay. You can read the unexpurgated version of it and more like it at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which Amazon wraps up the free publicity trifecta it's been enjoying the past day or two, thanks in large part to the White House. Yesterday, ahead of the president's speech, it was the 7,000 new jobs that Amazon is adding. Today, the speech, of course, at that warehouse. And tomorrow, a brand new Amazon singles ebook featuring the aforementioned president of the United States. Mr. Obama is sitting down for an interview with the editor of Amazon singles today. It's going to be available in the morning, free, I should add. All right, look at the time. We got to go. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. Thanks to Sean Bownich, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is 8 p.m.